The China in Africa podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg. The ACRP promotes balanced, considered reporting on China-Africa relations through training programs held throughout the year. More information at africachinareporting.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China in Africa podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Podcast Network. I'm Eric Olander, and as always, I'm joined by CGSP's managing editor Kobus van Staden in Johannesburg and CGSP's Africa editor Jeronima from the beautiful island of Mauritius. A very good afternoon to you, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It is great to have you here. I've been looking forward to today's show for a number of days because there's so much that's happened this week. Again, the China-Africa space is in this kind of flux right now where there's not a lot going on, but when things are going on, it's really interesting. So we're going to do a week in review show this week. We're going to cover three issues. Number one is Naledi Pandor, who's the equivalent of the foreign minister, the director of international relations and cooperation from South Africa. She was in Washington. She had a very fascinating discussion at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And the themes that came out in that discussion were very interesting, and I'm really keen to get Kobus's take on that. Then we're going to talk about João Lourenço's visit to China. He is the Angolan president. He came back last weekend with his hands full and his suitcase packed with deals and debt reductions and all sorts of goodies from his trip in China. We're going to talk about that. And then finally, there was a signing ceremony this week in Kinshasa about the deal of the century, if you remember that back in 2008. That was the Sicumines deal for $6.2 billion. Now, that was a very controversial deal. Since then, what's happened is there's been a restructuring of some of the infrastructure parts of that. Well, Giraud's going to explain to us what happened this week and why it's important and why it's not so important. And we're going to get kind of this is in many ways the period at the end of a very long sentence that goes on to explain what's happened with this major, major binding deal between the two. Let's go now first to South Africa, Naledi Pandor. She was in Washington. And Kobus, the reason why I wanted to talk to you about this is because in the entire hour and a half discussion that she had at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, she did not mention the word China once. Neither did the questioners. There was no specific questions about that. Also, it reflected a similar tone that I heard on Capitol Hill last week when the regional commanders from CENTCOM, AFRICOM, and even SOUTHCOM were testifying before both the House and Senate. And the questions about China were much more subdued than they were in previous years, particularly with Michael Langley, who is the head of AFRICOM, and General Michael Langley. And he avoided some of the pitfalls that he's fallen into earlier is about debt traps and things like that. I just get a sense that there's a different tone in Washington today about the Chinese in Africa, and that the fear or the hysteria that we've seen over the past 10 or 12 years seems to be fading a little bit. You watched the Pandor discussion. You've also been following what's been going on. What do you think about the general tenor of the discussion going on these days?
It was a very interesting listen because Pandor is she's formidable. She's, I think, one of South Africa's the most popular politicians, I think, within South Africa. And she's, I think, one of the best articulators of the kind of complexities of South African foreign policy. So it was really interesting to hear her and then to hear her kind of being challenged and responding to these challenges. South Africa has a very specific kind of take on foreign policy, and she kind of unpacks that quite well. And then she also kind of makes clear, without particularly kind of picking any fights with anyone, she always kind of positions it in the context of kind of power differentials, you know, between kind of richer global north countries and the rest of the world. So I think that made for sometimes, you know, kind of interesting kind of clashes between her and, you're not clashes, but like, you know, kind of disagreements between her and the kind of like general direction of the questions. But then she's such a kind of a class act, you know, kind of that it's always fascinating to see how she navigates that.
But were you surprised that China didn't come up as a topic? Because typically in Washington, at least in the past 10 years that you and I have been following it as closely as we've been, the first or second question has always been about the relationship with China, particularly with South Africa being a member of the BRICS, holding military exercises with the Chinese, major Chinese trading partner for minerals and whatnot. But yet China didn't come up at all in that discussion.
Yes, that was interesting for me. It was interesting also, as you say, that at the hearings of the different commanders, China generally didn't come up. But one contrast was the hearing John Aquilino took, the commander of the Indo-Pacific Command. Well, he was saying that China and Russia are working together and they're essentially cohering a new axis of evil, quote unquote, kind of, you know, around them. So there's an interesting contrast, you know. But in general, yeah, like it's very interesting that they're seemingly kind of de-emphasizing China at the moment in the messaging, which is an interesting move.
No, in general, Laura Richardson, who is the head of Southcom, she talked a lot more about China, but it was the AFRICOM part that wasn't. So, Joel, let me bring you in on this conversation. Do you notice a different tenor in the discussion, at least coming from the United States, that there doesn't seem to be as much anxiety about the Chinese in Africa as there was, or are we just misreading this?
I do believe the anxiety is still there, still present, because China cannot be removed from the picture, especially when you do have the Lobito Corridor project ongoing. So my take is the fact when I was listening to Lady Pandor talking and speaking during that conversation, I had the feeling that they did not want to bring China. They mentioned once, I think they mentioned Russia once, they didn't want to bring China into the mix because a trip in Washington was much more about South Africa position and the threat about AGOA and the United States. And I think they wanted her to much more articulate what South Africa foreign policy was in general, especially in the criticism it's been receiving from legislators in DC. So that's why I believe that China did not really come up during the conversation. So she kind of did a very decent, an excellent job. I love Naledi Pandor. She's just, as Kobe said, she's one of the most articulated South African politicians out there. And she really makes sense in what she said. And I think she really just made sense in a way that she addressed all those issues in a very diplomatic fashion way. And she even had the opportunity to throw a bit of shade and a bit of threat against the United States about the AGOA in a very diplomatic way, which I really liked.
Well, let's give you a little flavor of that back and forth that she had in both Kobus and Giraud have referenced. Now, she was in conversation with Dan Baer, who is a senior vice president for policy research and director of the Europe program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also a former U.S. ambassador to the OSCE. You know, he had an exchange with her, and I thought this was the most interesting exchange of the whole hour and a half, which, again, it speaks to Kobus, what he was saying in terms of her ability to respond to this indignation and somewhat sanctimonious approach from a lot of Western stakeholders. Let's take a listen to the discussion between Dan Baer and South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor.
The BRICS recently invited 6 new members. Mm-hmm. 4 of which are authoritarian regimes. One is a democratic regime that is in the midst of an ongoing conflict. And one is a democratic country that has just elected a far-right leader. How do you square? I understand that those governments have legal personality that gives them the authority to engage in international fora. Mm-hmm. But they certainly don't have democratic legitimacy the way that your government does. And so how do we as an international community, when we think about reform of the Security Council, when we think about reforming the way that the World Bank or the IMF works, you spoke about giving a broader voice to developing countries. So many of them are currently led by non-democratic governments. How do we square the lack of legitimacy that those governments have at home with the argument to give them more of a voice in international affairs?
Well, the question I would pose to you is, who makes these judgments? Because I don't know, you know, this assessment that
you're
making.
So you would challenge the premise that Iran, for example, is an authoritarian regime?
Well, is it your role to make that judgment?
Oh, I don't think it's me who's saying that. I think it's widely regarded by most people with legitimacy around the world.
I don't know whether they are an authoritarian regime. I do know that women.
Sorry, can you just repeat that? The Minister of Foreign Affairs of International Cooperation, yes. Of International Relations and Cooperation of South Africa, mm-hmm. does not know whether the regime in Iran is authoritarian.
Yes, no, I'm not aware of. I don't have that definition in my logbook. I do have a concern about women and their rights in Iran, and this is something that I have discussed with the government of Iran, particularly my colleague, the foreign minister. I believe what we have to do as South Africa is not close off engagement with any country but also to use our own democratic success as an example to others to say, this actually works.
Cobus, what did you hear in that exchange? Because I think in so many ways it wrapped up the fundamental problem that many U.S. and European stakeholders have in dealing with Africa and other parts of the Global South in terms of the sanctimoniousness of their tone. Everybody with legitimacy, that was the word he used, with legitimacy, knows. And then also interesting, he uses the word regime, which is, of course, another way to cast doubt on governments. There's the Chinese regime, there's the Iranian regime. You never talk about the French regime or the German regime or the Spanish regime. These are condescending types of framings that they use. But I'd like to get both of your guys' reaction to that. First, Cobus, let's get you. Obviously, she is your foreign minister. You've talked about how she is so good at sparring, and this was a great example of that.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I had some sympathy for both sides of this exchange. You know, I think they asked an important question, even though I think it wasn't framed perfectly. But it is important to ask, particularly in the case of South Africa, who is dealing with a bunch of governments, particularly Russia, you know, kind of that are very problematic in lots of ways in you know, kind of how they treat their own people and how they treat, you know, kind of people in other countries. So I think it is important to ask the question of, like, where legitimacy lies, you know, but at the same time, you know, it was in front of an audience, you know, he wanted to pin down a statement to her. And of course, I think on her side, I think there's an assumption, I think, in his question, and this is a broadly shared assumption, that being a democratically elected government makes you legitimate, right? And that if you're not a democratically elected government, that inherently makes you illegitimate, which is sure, you know, I can see where that comes from. But at the same time, we're living in a world where we know that China, for example, is not a democratic country. And yet, you know, according to a lot of different kinds of polls, taking into account that polling in China is complicated, at the same time, there's many polls showing that there's quite high levels of approval of the government among ordinary Chinese. So in the first place, legitimacy and democracy go together frequently, but they're not necessarily the same thing. Because if you're looking at a situation like the UK at the moment, right, kind of where there's essentially this gridlock system, very, very low popularity on all sides, you know, like that's a democratic system. How legitimate the government is in the UK at the moment is a different question, right? But as you say, there is an optics of condescension that's happening at the same time, right? And like later on in the interview, she was making the point that very frequently African governments are singled out by, for example, the International Criminal Court for censure, whereas more powerful governments get away with whatever they want to do, right? And I think there she was kind of like honing in on the kind of power differential that I think rankles everyone, you know, kind of in the background around this kind of exchange, I think.
And let's not forget that Americans are treading on very thin ice when they talk about legitimacy like this, because don't forget, George W. Bush and Donald Trump did not win the presidency with a majority of the vote. Remember that. They won the Electoral College, but more people voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump. And so we get into some really weird kind of spaces when it comes to legitimacy in politics and presidencies. Giraud, what was your take?
It was really interesting to hear her answer, because we don't realize how much a narrative reflects the extent of how Chinese narrative has been now not only propagating, has been now winning in many countries in the Global South. The narrative of not questioning the nature of the legitimacy of a government. The narrative where no Western country can now stand and say, I deem you being democratic, I deem you being autocratic. That was a first response. Who qualifies them the way they are? Who says they the way they are? Basically asking you, you are not in the position to start questioning the legitimacy, the nature of those government or those regime, the way you call them. And this is somehow, when I heard that speaking, I was like, yeah, this is slowly how Chinese narrative has been, propagating, has been, China has been talking about it for so many years, but now you have much more Global South countries, powerful Global South countries like South Africa, now taking a stand now against the background of countries' sovereignty, really taking the stand by saying there's no norm by which no country should be now asking or questioning somehow the legitimacy or the democratic nature of a country. And that's really walks into the background of China Global Civilization Initiative, where China has been pushing that there's no one single path. There are multiple paths to democracy, to development, to countries' development and everything. And there's no country that has the moral high ground or legitimacy to come and question each country's historical and democratic path. And that's where I found the answer very much interesting. And I don't know if people really paid attention to how much this narrative now is becoming more and more common in the global South. And we may find ourselves in the next years where that debate will be very much an open debate, even question a lot of things that we do understand right now, the way we see international system and countries.
Yeah, Jérôme, I think you make a good point. It just speaks to the importance that if people in the US and Europe and other parts of the global north want to engage effectively countries like South Africa, just it feels like to me a different tone and a different approach needs to be taken. And I thought the way that Dan Baer approached that line of questioning and the tone he had. And the other thing I would have said if I was Pandora, it was like, listen, you've been a diplomat. You've been an ambassador. You know that somebody in my position can't say those things. That's just not the way that foreign ministers talk. And, you know, I thought it was kind of a dumb question. And also to say, you mean to tell me that the Iran, you're like,
But that was also, that was really interesting because when he repeated the question, it was like that gotcha moment. Like, let the record show that Naledi Pandor doesn't think like that. I mean,
then that's not how foreign ministers work. Do you know what I mean? You would never get Blinken to say anything like that. They just don't work like that. So Anyway, a fascinating discussion. There is, in my view, and again, I feel that there's a change in the tone as in Washington. As Jérôme pointed out, the anxiety is probably still there. It's just not being talked about as much as it was. And these visits by foreign ministers and the commanders up on the Hill, and we're not seeing as much coming out of the White House as well about China in Africa. It's just interesting. It's a different take.
If you let me to add on something on that, I do believe that the change of tone that you've noticed is due to the fact that maybe some people in the State Department, in the White House, or even up in the Capitol Hill, they don't want to put China in the front anymore, especially when they engage in Africa, in a way that we've been telling them that when the US engage Africa, is always about China. And I think that they're really now trying hard to remove China narrative in the equation, to really put forward what the US has to offer, instead of like, we are coming because we're worried about China. And I think somehow, even though they have China in the back of their mind, they don't want to put it up front out there to kind of tell people, this is why we are coming to Africa. In a certain way as well, is also to kind of tell African countries that don't judge us based on the fact that we always say that we are coming from China. We want to show you that we are coming for ourselves and the way we see Africa and as a valuable partners.
Well, that's a perfect segue into our next topic, because one of the areas where the U.S. is most active in Africa today is Angola. And with the Lobito Corridor, we've talked about that a lot on the show. Angola was the focus of China-Africa relations really last week, but into the weekend. So we wanted to kind of bring you up to date on it. President João Lourenço went to Beijing for a very short 3.5-day visit. And I say that short because previous visits by Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi, William Ruto from Kenya, and even the recent visit from President Bio from Sierra Leone were 5-6 days, which are very, very long for heads of state to be away. And so this trip by President Lourenço was action-packed. There was no ceremonial stuff of him going to, you know, Fujian province to look at the history of communism and all this other stuff. He came there to do business. And boy, did he do business. Number one, let me just go through a few of the things and then I'd like to get your take on this, guys. Number one, he walked away with an upgrade in diplomatic ties to comprehensive strategic cooperative partnership. Now, that may not mean a lot to you, but to the Chinese, they have these hierarchies of diplomatic relationships, and the Comprehensive Strategic Cooperative Partnership is the third highest ranking in the hierarchy. So they're moving up, and I think in many ways that is a reflection of Angola's importance in the great power competition with the United States. Also, CNOOC, the big Chinese state-owned oil company, they announced that they're going to be sending another delegation to Angola for more oil exploration talks. That ran a little bit counter to the narrative that Angola is trying to move beyond oil, but yet oil is a very important part of the Angolan economy. They held an Angola-China business forum in Beijing that a lot of people walked away from that feeling very encouraged by what they heard. Also, the two sides signed a bunch of memorandums of understanding. We don't know if anything's in those MOUs and what they're worth, but at least they signed them. But the big takeaway that came out of this, and this was a very big win, Angola will now save $200 million a month in its loan servicing to the China Development Bank. That is an enormous win for Lourenco. Not a lot of countries have been able to get that kind of debt reduction. Certainly William Ruto in Kenya must be going, what the F? How did he get that and I didn't? The Kenyans have been asking for loan restructuring from the Chinese for years and never got it. Just very quickly, let me just give you up to date on the debt situation. So Angola was ground zero for China-Africa debt, encompassing almost a third of the $150 billion that China lent to African countries from 2000 to 2022. $45 billion in total. They've whittled that down to $17 billion. Now it accounts for about 40% of Angola's total debt, and almost 80% of all of that is in oil for resources loans. Giraud, what's your take on the Lourenco visit? And put it in the context again of the other visits that we've been tracking over the past 6 months and how you thought Lourenco did and what he came away with.
I think that Lourenco managed his trip to China quite well because he really somehow, as you mentioned, came up with some substantial win for him, because coming out from China with $200 million that you can save per month when you service your debt to China is a major win, especially when you have in the background, you have Zambia case where Zambia is still struggling to find his $13.1 billion restructure. The discussion's been going on. So Angola being able to manage some win over with Chinese financials, it's something that can quite interesting. It's also interesting to see how Angola managed to play his card right in the context where now is the middle of this geopolitical battle between the West and China around the Lobito Corridor about everything that's happened. Angola is becoming the ground zero for the West counter offensive on China's presence in Africa, at least the way they're presenting it. So you kind of see now when Joao is going to China, when he's having those deals, when he's seeing the diplomatic relationship with China being raised to that strategic comprehensive level, it tells you that, you know, I'm still not turning away from China. China remains a very important partner for me, and we're going to keep on working with China. And as you say, $17 billion remaining to pay to China, and the most of it has to be paid by exports oil to China. Let's not forget that in December, Angola expressed his willingness to leave the OPEC, the producer of oil organization, wanting to reinforce his agreement with China and everything. So in that overall context, we can see that Angola is really trying to balance its position with China, with the US, and remaining the very useful partner. And clearly, Joao is telling people that I'm not picking any side. I'm going to try to take the best of what you can offer to me right now. So that was a very interesting trip to follow. And him visiting Shandong instead of going to Huawei and all of those places was really quite interesting. I believe that they prepared the trip quite well, and he came up with much more success compared to what his predecessor came out with from China.
So Zhao mentioned Shandong province. For those of you not familiar, Shandong is in northeast China. It's one of China's largest provinces, but not one that's frequently on the itinerary of African heads of state. In fact, I can't remember when an African head of state went to Shandong before. Normally, as Giraud pointed out, they'll go to Guangdong, which is where Shenzhen is. That's the tech center. They'll go to Guangzhou oftentimes, which is where the African diaspora hub is. They'll go even to Zhejiang, Huawei. Now a lot are going to Shanghai, where the headquarters of the New Development Bank is, and obviously a financial hub. Shandong, though, is an industrial hub. It's also the headquarters of Hisense and Haier. Those are two companies that many Africans may actually know well. Those are white goods and electronics manufacturers that have big operations in southern Africa. In fact, even in Angola, they are also a hub for pharmaceuticals, auto manufacturing. And so if a country like Angola is looking to move beyond oil and to industrialize, then going to a place like Shandong actually makes a lot of sense. And Cobus, is one of these very interesting things. I looked up the size of the Shandong GDP, and it is $1.2 trillion. So that would put it into some one of the largest countries in the world, actually, just that economy alone, bigger than most Southeast Asian, all African countries. And so it made a lot of sense for him to go to Shandong. But I want to pick up this question with you, Cobus, that Giraud raised, that we are in the midst of a great power competition between the U.S. and China. Angola was a frontline state in the last Cold War, and here it is again, a frontline state in whatever this new competition is. Why do you think Angola keeps finding itself in this position?
Just looking at the trip this week, it struck me that Angola might be emerging as the Vietnam of Africa, in that, you know, kind of it provides this very kind of concrete lesson on how to balance the superpowers. And particularly as Vietnam, you know, it has a long-term, very deep relationship with China. Like, you know, we mentioned the debt, but we should mention that Angola's debt to China was so big that many debt experts on Africa-China, you know, experts on Africa-China debt frequently tends to leave Angola out of some of their calculations because it tends to kind of skew the graphs so much because of the size of the debt. The fact that it had that debt, that it managed to pay off most of it, that it's in the process of managing it so effectively, that it is—it's kind of the opposite of a very interesting kind of counter argument to the idea of China as a debt trap lender. You know, kind of because even if one has so much debt to China, you can still manage to maneuver within that space. You know, Angola showed,
and China showed some flexibility in restructuring the loans too.
Exactly, and that flexibility happened against the background of Angola's rapidly warming up relationship with the U.S. You know, similar to Vietnam's. You know, so what both of them are showing is that if you want to get good stuff out of China, also make sure to also make good friends with the US. You know, because that then kind of like pushes China, you know, towards a kind of a friendlier position. And also that if you happen to be rapidly warming up your relationship with the US, that doesn't necessarily mean that your relationship with China has to suffer. You can have both at the same time. I think these countries are showing that. You know, so it's a very interesting kind of effect, I think, of the discussion. I think one of the reasons why Angola is such a strong contender is that it has a bunch of kind of like natural assets, not only resources in the form of oil, but also diamonds, but also, you know, kind of coastline, ports, etc. And it has always kind of represented an alternative to South Africa, in Southern Africa, I think. You know, so in that sense, I think it is also kind of leaning into some of the kind of complications that South Africa is having with some of its partners. And it just kind of like slowly emerging as like, oh yes, also Angola, you know, that I think is increasingly, particularly as it's now moving in its post kind of like dictatorship era. You know, it is, that's an interesting kind of trend, I think, to watch.
And Jill, just to pick up on the narrative that Cobus is talking about in terms of the parallels with Vietnam, the other aspect of this is geography. So just as Vietnam's geography is absolutely strategic for it, given its location at the crossroads of Indochina, you know, on the way with Indian influences and Chinese influences, Angola's geography at the foothills of the critical minerals that are in Zambia and the DRC are also very important. And that location allows it to serve the Lobito Corridor and the port of Lobito and to access those markets from those ports and those railways. So geography also seems to be playing a very important role for Angola.
Oh, yes, definitely. Geography is playing a very important role in that place. That's what Angola is having in that debate. Because let's face it, when you go back in the 1960s, even way before, when you see where the copper was coming from in the north of Zambia, south of DRC, the idea was when it was going to Europe, the easy way to get to Europe was through Angola, because Angola had a way out, easy way out to those places. So over the years, yes, Angola has managed to build that space where it was able to become a very important partner for many countries, especially in the Western countries in that place. And when you go back in during the Cold War, Angola played also an important role when it was about to kind of to do the policeman of Zaire at that time and different situation even late in the early 2000s. So all of those contexts put in place definitely puts Angola in a very interesting position right now, and to put itself being a very important partner for all of them. And for me, it's really, let's see how it's going to play out. Because when Cobus mentioned end of dictatorship, something will be interesting to look at. Like, we're going to have election in Angola in 2027. We still don't know if João Lourenço will want to change the constitution and go for a third term, or he will abide by the constitution and just leave his position for someone else. And this is where we are also going to see how much the US is going to be true to the principle of, you know, democracy and all of that, especially in that context of geopolitical competition.
Well, talking about the history of China and Angola, let's not forget that Angola was central in China's early engagement in Africa. That's where they went to first. It was obviously for oil. In fact, there was something called the Angola model that was created, which was the pioneer of the resources for infrastructure deal. Now, it's interesting because I met in Beijing at Peking University, the team that actually came up with that idea and initiated it. And back then when they said it was really done with a really good intention, in the sense that China was capital rich, resource poor. African countries like Angola were resource rich, but capital poor. They needed infrastructure. China had the capacity to build infrastructure. So chocolate, peanut butter, put it together, and here you got something. Now, it caused a lot of problems because what ended up happening in Angola was 75-80% of their oil was committed to the Chinese. What ended up happening is they weren't selling it on the open market. Not enough cash was coming into the economy, and that pushed inflation just sky high, and that really set back Angola. And so there's been a reevaluation lately of the resources for infrastructure deals. We haven't seen anywhere near as many of them in Africa as we've seen. They pop up from time to time. Remember, the Ghana did a bauxite for infrastructure deal recently, and we're going to talk about what happened in the Congo next. But I just want to bring you some sound right now, some comments that the president of the African Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, he gave an interview with the Associated Press and just slammed resource for infrastructure agreements and said they're just terrible for African countries.
The risk that one has with natural resource-backed loans, as far as I'm concerned, is that they are just bad, bad, and bad. First and foremost, because you can't price the asset properly. If you have minerals, oil, metals, and gas under the ground, it's not actually been marketed. So how you actually come up with the price of that for a long-term contract, it's a challenge. The second is that the negotiation is very asymmetric. Most countries that want to do asset, natural resource-backed loans, are probably dealing with bigger countries, bigger commercial banks that want to give them a loan and say, well, look, it's urgent, we need it, but this is what you have to sign. But it is those that actually want to give the loan that have the upper power, not the person who wants or the country that wants to receive the loan. And I'm particularly worried, I must say, for Africa, in the sense that the volume of concessional financing, okay, low-cost concessional financing, has been going down over time. I think Africa should put an end to natural resource-backed loans.
Kobe, it's fascinating that he brought up the question of asymmetry. This is a level of honesty that I haven't seen ever before from someone of Adesina's stature. He didn't mention the Chinese by name, but Lord, who else do you think he's talking about when he's talking about power asymmetries on resource for infrastructure loans and resource-backed loans? I mean, to be fair, though, the Chinese are by no means the only ones. Glencore does a lot of these deals. BlackRock has done these deals. So it's not only Chinese. Let's be very clear. I think in Chad, it was BlackRock in Chad, if I remember correctly. I might be wrong on that. But certainly Glencore has put a lot of money in on resource for infrastructure loans as well. But in terms of official lenders, boy, it is the Chinese. Well, he didn't say the Chinese by name, though. But the power asymmetry was very interesting.
But it is also interesting that also in China, there's a move away from resource-backed loans, I think, recently. You know, there were good reasons to do them. You know, like not only the factors that you mentioned, but there were also, you know, in some ways, a way around official corruption in some recipient countries, you know, like particularly the kind of nightmare that you had in a place like Nigeria in the 80s, you know, kind of where project funds would just be siphoned off and then end up in some bank account in New York, the country can't get it back. I think Nigeria is still fighting to get some of that money back. So in that sense, you know, that it was a kind of a hedge against that kind of problem. But I think, you know, we're also in a different African moment. You know, there's a larger push towards moving up value chains. There's a more strategic view of how minerals are supposed to fuel development. There's a move towards more kind of oversight and a focus on illicit financial flows, you know, kind of from the African Union and so on. So you know, it's the right moment, I think, to have that conversation about whether these mechanisms still fulfill any function.
For me, I disagree a bit with Adesina. If he had presented it based on what you said, Kobe, is that due to where we are right now, the political economic situation of many African countries, the needs to move from value chain when it comes to natural resources, that the resource for infrastructure are not appropriate for the moment anymore, I would say yes. But when he presented it to be like just bad, I think he's oversimplifying so many factors that really come from African responsibility in those deals. If we take, for example, countries like the DRC, Angola, all those countries had built infrastructure that was able to boost development, economic development. If they didn't go on just picking and choosing political project that regime or quote-unquote regime and government needed to show the people that we are doing something, but without real economic development values, by the time we are here, 24 years later, I do believe that many countries would have benefited tremendously by having strong infrastructure that boosts the economic development. But the reality is most of them use infrastructure for political need and political purpose, building stadium in villages, building infrastructure that just don't make sense, embezzling money and everything. So when you take that into context, you realize that now, for me, yes, if it's for the moment that we are right now, maybe it's not appropriate anymore. But just presenting it all flats being bad, it's very much oversimplifying the complexity and the responsibility that many African countries had into those deal being a complete failure.
Okay, well, let's talk about what's gone on in your country, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There was a $7 billion restructuring of the $6.2 billion Sicomines deal. And this is something that has been in the works for years. This is the ultimate now resource for infrastructure deal, where the Chinese are pulling out copper and cobalt, and in exchange, they are building roads, hospitals, all sorts of things throughout the DRC. Question, what happened this week? But also, what is the legitimacy of this deal in the context of what Adesina was saying?
Basically, what's happened, it happened during the weekend last week, where they finally signed the agreement to the 2008 agreement they signed with the Chinese consortium of Chinese company and the government. They finally, it was official signing, because we've covered that story early January when they released the main headlines of the agreement. They found that now the envelope that was that was earmarked for infrastructure will go from $3 billion to $7 billion. And mind you now, Chinese say they already invested $1.5 billion in infrastructure, so it remained $5 billion more to add into infrastructure. They're going to be spending $300 million a year in terms of building infrastructure, which basically means that they're going to be covered within 17 years. So what does it mean? It means that, yeah, politically, President Tshisekedi has managed to get, I'd say, a certain level of success by restructuring the deal, but I'm not going to go into the details of the deal because we've covered it before.
Hold on, but can he say that he has fulfilled his promise to restructure these unfair deals? Can he say that now that he did that?
Can he say that? I would say no. He cannot say that, because when you get into the nitty-gritty of the deals, and this is where Adesina might be right in terms of the value of the resources that's been put on the table, what we've got in exchange and everything. No, he did not succeed. He got a politically correct agreement that allows him to say, I increased the envelope from $3 billion to $7 billion of infrastructure, and I managed to make sure that every year we're going to have $364 million put just for infrastructure in the country. Now the question will become, where those infrastructure will be built? But this is something else. But if technically and economically speaking, in terms of value, in terms of really what DRC could have obtained, nah, he cannot say that. But politically, yes, he can say that, because when you go from 3 to 7 billion, it's a big numbers. But when you span it over 15, 17 years, yeah, you put yourself in perspective that things are not as much as success that you want to believe.
Jerome, has there been any further clarification about which specific infrastructure they're planning on building? Like, you know, I've seen some mention that Chinese teams are now fixing roads and so on in the DRC. But like, do they have some kind of transformative infrastructure plan kind of in place for actual development?
So far, nothing has been made public. They say they have, but we're going to have to be waiting every year. Because in this situation, the government is going to be the one to come to the SICOM in the joint venture where you have the ERC and Jekamin. They're going to go there to say, we need that much money to build that infrastructure. So far, we don't know. But what we should expect that we might expect to see, this is my fear, because there's not a lot of transparency in those deals. We might find ourselves again building just white elephants infrastructure that just don't make sense in economically speaking. And I have to say that even though it's clearly said that this money will be used for road only, so we cannot expect to see stadium being built, we cannot expect to see power plants being built, we should be expecting to see road infrastructure being built. But this is the DRC, things can change anytime and things can just not be implemented the way you expect it to be.
But let's be very clear here. The decision as to what infrastructure is built is not a Chinese decision. That's up to the local stakeholders. So when a lot of people blame the Chinese for building these white elephants, you know, you got to blame the locals. And this is where agency matters here and accountability matters here, that they want to put a stadium in the middle of a village. And you think, what are you doing? You know, that just makes no sense. The Chinese are agnostic about it. They're like, OK, if you want to do this, knock yourself out. It's just going to knock down the bill that we have in terms of what we owe you. The quick question that I have for you on this deal was, and again, this goes back to Adesina's point about the difficulty of pricing these resource for infrastructure deals. When, you know, at the peak of the Sicomines deal, cobalt was soaring high in the price. Today, cobalt is in the basement, terrible pricing, and it doesn't look like it's going to increase anytime soon. Copper, interestingly enough, is still very high. But do you see a scenario down the road, if cobalt stays very, very low, that the Chinese renegotiate these deals again to say, listen, we're not generating as much out of these contracts as we thought we were, so we're going to reduce the amount of infrastructure that we build accordingly?
But that is interesting, because the renegotiation, they've used copper price as the reference for those amounts to be disbursed. So it's really not about the cobalt revenue that Sicomine was going to make. They're going to use it. And plus, I think we've said it before, Sicomine is not really a cobalt company. It's much more a copper company than a cobalt company. So yeah, they really use the money based on the copper revenue than the cobalt revenue. I think they're much aware of the situation. They see how the trend is going, and it won't be smart for them to negotiate based on the revenue for cobalt, because at some point they would just say, guys, we don't have enough money to do that. But with copper, they're quite sure, and they're fairly sure that, you know, the price will still remain to a certain extent high. But even if they go low, they won't be a disaster.
Cobus, the part of this signing ceremony this week that struck me, and everything that what Giraud has been telling me, is that the Chinese have been able to not only survive in a place like the DRC, which you cannot take for granted. The DRC is one of the most difficult places on the planet to do business. But in many ways, they've been able to thrive. Not always to the benefit of the Congolese. Again, the asymmetry that Adesina talked about is certainly at play in the DRC. But the fact that they've had the durability and the longevity in that country, I do find rather remarkable, given the fact that that's not an easy place to do business, much less, you know, in many other parts of Africa. But it shows a dexterity, I think, that a lot of other countries and cultures have not been able to have in Africa over the decades.
And it's, of course, you know, also not a situation of their making, you know, kind of unlike Belgium and the United States and other, you know, actors who are to a certain extent the authors of the current nightmare in the DRC, or at least very complicit in that. Like, the Chinese kind of inherited a highly disrupted situation and then ended up thriving there. So, you know, that's very interesting. I would love to be a fly on the wall in private, off the record discussions among Chinese actors about what it takes to make it work in the DRC, you know. I think there's some interesting kind of secrets there.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that be incredible if we could get, I mean, just like some Chinese mining executive to come and talk to us openly, as you know, I mean, that would just be incredible. I mean, it'll never happen, but it'll be amazing.
Oh, I can imagine.
I can tell you some of them in private, they complain a lot. And this is just to speak about the corruption. Some of them, when you hear them talking, they say, you know, what's happening in the US is just a mess. It's very much the kind of corruption that you see here that gets you to nothing, because all the parts where we kind of quote unquote adapt by paying the leaders and they leave us alone down the hierarchy. But in DRC, we just have to pay everybody at every level. At the end, we get nothing done. So it's just a real nightmare for all of us. So yeah, even them, they do complain a lot.
Okay. Just before we go, I want to throw you guys a curveball. We did not plan to have this discussion, but I just want to see if you have any top line thinking on it. The U.S. was kicked out of Niger this week. It all fell apart. Apparently, Mali Fee, the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, was in the country and had a very bad meeting with the junta that we don't know the details of it, but boy, it somehow they said it did not go well. How do you think this impacts the Chinese in the Sahel, in Niger? They seem to be kind of still plodding along, still going along. They're not been the subject of attention much. The Niger-Benin pipeline is moving quite well. Any thoughts on the situation in Niger after what happened with the U.S., Cobus or Jérôme? If you guys don't, that's okay, because I know I'm springing this on you, but I did want to see if you had any thoughts.
Well, you know, I think this is going to be an interesting kind of test case for the John Aquilino line of Russia and China working together to form an axis of evil. Because I think Russia and China's positions in Niger are so, and in the Sahel more broadly, are so radically different. You know, in the sense that China just doesn't have that kind of Wagner group kind of organization, you know, that kind of like wild card aspect of finding their own, you know, shady kind of opportunities in a very chaotic landscape. You know, like overall, China is still much more beholden to the party agenda. They're still playing within UN, you know, kind of confines a lot more than the Russians, who are just this kind of very different kind of animal, you know, in that region. So this is going to be very interesting to see, because my first thought was, well, if, you know, similar to the weakening of France's position in the Sahel, if the US is also kind of displaced from the region, then in theory, it would strengthen China's hand. In reality, I think it would probably strengthen Russia's hand, but I'm not sure that the Chinese are necessarily that happy about this development. But, you know, kind of, I completely speak under correction. Who knows what's happening, you know, behind the scenes.
Let's not forget that the Chinese have been freeloading off of U.S. security for a long time in Asia and in the Middle East as well. So yeah, the fact, exactly. I mean, again, I'm not entirely sure if the U.S. is a stabilizing force in Niger. That's not my field of expertise. But, you know, Jérôme, any thoughts on Niger?
For me, 2 points. First of all, this is where you see American realpolitik failing, because I remember when there was the coup in Niger, France had a complete different position because for its own geopolitical interest in the country. But France wanted the former president Bazoum to be reestablished in power and everything. But the United States took a rather realistic, safe position based on the fact that they had a military base, and they say it was much better to engage with the military junta than, you know, throwing them out and pushing them out. But today they realize that at the end they're losing, and the real politics did not play well for them. At the end, the winner of the real politics was Russia, because now Niger is moving much more closer to Russia. Second point, when you look at China is not as much as happy to the junta anymore, because they had a dispute starting a few weeks back about a new oil discovery made by Chinese CNPC. Chinese CNPC wanted to have the oil discovery because they discovered it to manage the new field, but the junta decided to strip away the oil concession to give it to the national company Sonidep. So in that context, even CNPC, even though they have the pipeline, the Agadem pipeline going from Niger to Benin ongoing, CNPC is not really happy because they've put billions of dollars into those discovery, and now seeing just the reserve being taken away from them doesn't make them really happy about CNPC, about the junta. Anyway, they still kind of benefit by the overall situation where the US is not so welcome anymore.
Well, we got a bonus topic in there today. So 4 topics, normally we do 3, but thank you, gentlemen, both for your time. Always fun for us to get together to hash these things out. By the way, if you ever heard what our normal calls sound like, this is basically it. When we're just chatting amongst each other on Slack, this is what we sound like. So you're just kind of getting exactly what our normal... In fact, Cobus and I were talking before Jérôme came on the line, and he was like, did I just interrupt some kind of intellectual conversation? We're like, no, we're just chatting away. That's how we normally do it. So this podcast podcast is really kind of what we do in our spare time. And this is, you know, we just love to geek out on this. If you enjoy the discussions that we did today, then you're going to love the work that Giraud and Kobus and Johnny and the rest of the team are doing every day on the China Global South Project website. It's a fantastic service. I'm just so excited. We're adding a new section, by the way, in the next few days called CGSP in the News. And it's going to feature all of the appearances that the various team members make in Foreign Policy Magazine, The Washington Post, in Le Monde, and all the other places where we're interviewed quite regularly, both to showcase the great insights from the CGSP team, but also because there's a lot of great coverage coming out there. And so we're going to put that up on the homepage, so keep an eye out for that. Of course, if you want to get access to everything on the site, we would love for you to become a subscriber. It supports the independent, agenda-free, nonpartisan journalism that we're doing, and it keeps the lights on for us, because if you don't support this kind of work, it goes away. It's that simple. And so we desperately need your support. And I don't lie about it, that running a media company in today's era is not easy to do and to stay solvent. So your support is absolutely essential to keep independent voices going. If you'd like to subscribe, go to chinaglobalsouth.com/subscribe. We've got monthly and annual subscriptions. And if you are a student, email me, eric@chinaglobalsouth.com, and I will send you the links for the half-off discounts. So that'll be it for this edition of the China and Africa podcast. Kobus, Giraud, and I will be back again next week with another edition. And also, don't miss Giraud's videos up on our YouTube channel. The links are in the show notes. He's doing some great work there. So for Giraud in Mauritius and Kobus in Johannesburg, I'm Eric Olander. Thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Tag us on Twitter at ChinaGSProject and visit us at ChinaGlobalSouth.com. If you speak French, check out our full coverage at ProjetAfriqueChine.com and AfriqueChine on Twitter. That's Afrique with a K. And you'll also find links to our sites and social media channels in Arabic.